Afternoon, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Head School with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. Today we're coming to you from the National College of Art and Design, and our topic is Housing in Ireland, a History of Dysfunction? I'm joined by housing activist Aisling Haderman, architectural historian Ellen Rowley, and economic historian Conor McCabe.
Sorry, Ellen, I just want to bring you in this just before we move into the independence period, because there would have been theories of garden suburbs and so on and so forth. So, like, had that those ideas, had they arrived in Dublin even before independence?
Yeah, Tommy, they had. There was a report called the Tudor-Walters Report, which was published in 1918, which prescribed house dimensions, house design, estate layouts. So the Tudor-Walter Report was handed over to the first government, if you like, and the first government devised a housing manual based on it from 1924. But it was based on, as you say, the garden suburb, that idea, the garden city, and that whole idea whereby you'd have these self-contained new towns on the periphery of cities and towns, where you'd have schools and industry and social and pastoral infrastructure, that those ideas were passed over directly to Dublin Corporation by two garden suburb theorists, Raymond Unwin and Patrick Geddes, and also Barry Parker. So two or three of those at any time were advising Dublin Corporation in the 1910s.
Now, I mean, there were a few positive things happened, like, before independence. I'm thinking of, you know, these lovely labourers' cottages you see around the place and so on. Aisling, was there something similar in Dublin?
Yeah, so our town cottages road just facing the goblet would have been labourer cottages. My family actually received one in the 1800s, late 1800s. So my great-great-granddad would have been a labourer in the quarries across where St. David's Industrial, famous industrial school was. And the unions actually built these houses for people, workers that had children. So we were removed from the old style cottage where many people lived in the cottage with a hole in the roof, and we were put into these two roomed cottages that had land on the back, and realistically it gave us an opportunity then to engage better in life and to work and to have these kind of extra privileges.
So they were built by the trade unions, but who ended up owning them?
So then over time the Dublin City Council ended up taking ownership and bought them from the unions.
So they become part of the general story that we're about to expand on now, right? So from what you're saying, Conor, it seems to me that on independence, the policies were there, but not the funding.
Well, I mean, like, there was a kind of class element here as well. So you do get, like, that idea of the respectable kind of working classes who can pay their own way, who can kind of go forward. Like, public housing, as we know it, it's really from the 1930s in terms of, like, volume. And also, it's not statewide, because how it's been funded is through local government bonds. So it's only really the larger, the local authorities who can actually go to the bond markets and actually get kind of funding. So it's Cork, it's Limerick, it's Dublin as well. Like, so, like, you know, there is a bit of a rose-tinted glasses kind of view that's put back on kind of all of this. It was very kind of haphazard, it was very kind of low-key. And the government really really kind of fell back on kind of emigration as a way of, like, solving the housing.
Yeah, just before we proceed, by the way, I just want to, just a word for the people gathered around here, that this is a History on Head School, like, so you are meant to be educated and entertained and so on, but you're also expected to participate. So if you have any questions at any stage, just put your hand up. We don't just have a Q&A session at the end. You can intervene at any stage in this discussion and ask the panel a difficult question. Okay, let's move on then to the big schemes then. First, did the coming to power of, say, Fianna Fáil in 1932 have any effect? I mean, was there any change of policy? Or is it coincidental that all the big schemes happened after they came to power, Conor?
Oh, it's definite. I mean, just in terms of, like, numbers, I mean, there's about, just offhand, it's a few thousand, like, cottages that are being kind of built. And they're being built mainly Faulkner Ports then as well. If that changes to kind of tens of thousands from like 32 on to 1941. So you get kind of Carbrae being built and so forth. So there's a huge change in like policy, and that kind of class element of building housing for the kind of working class really kind of takes off in the 1930s.
Okay, so I'm thinking of Cabra, Ballyfermot, Crumlin, Kimmage, and the houses all kind of look more or less the same, right? What's the theory behind this, Ellen, the architectural theory?
I mean, I'm not sure I'm fully, I wouldn't be as conversant as you, Connor, in terms of, I don't know anything about the money, but it seems from an architectural perspective, the ideas are very much in place in the 20s around what a flat should be like and what a cottage should be like, and the legislation is 31 and 32, so I kind of felt it was quite coincidental. It was this move to, you know, sort out the slums once and for all, but it gains traction with this first Fianna Fáil government, I suppose. But it looked like the seeds were very much planted in the decade before. Well, certainly in terms of typologies, that's, you know, housing types. I suppose what's interesting, like echoing what Connor's saying, is that the amount of these things just completely escalates at this stage from 32. And you have Cabra being laid out, but at the same time you have all these what we call brownfield sites in the city centre, which would be to do with slum clearance or former industrial sites, and you have this solution of four-storey flat blocks being put up through the 1930s into the 40s. And those flat blocks look really like what the architects are seeing in Holland, but also in Liverpool and around London. So you've got this two-pronged effect, the cottage, as was termed, out in the suburb. And as you say, they are identical. You know, you got this idea where you clear your farmland and you make your waterways, your sanitation, your lighting, and then you put one house up after the other. The idea, of course, is that you can live more healthily with fresher air at lower density. And it's a little bit like what you were saying, Aisling, about your Artain cottages, that you have this big back garden, so you'll be self-sufficient. And that's very much coming from the 1910s and into the 20s, coming out of the sailors and soldiers trust. So every sailor and soldier coming out of World War I would be self-sufficient.
Yeah, but it's a big ask to expect, say, people from the inner city to become like small farmers, like at the back of their house, you know? And, you know, because you see, like, even to this day, like, these places are just kind of wildernesses, you know, at the back, with some exceptions, of course, you know. Now, the thing is, you've mentioned this, Connor, right? The context here is a falling population, right? Like, so this is different than our situation today. Falling population, but very little resources, right, for the state to play around with, right? And I want to pose this question, but we may come back to it later, because it always struck me that in the 30s and 40s, this impoverished state was actually able to house huge numbers of people, you know, in reasonably good houses. I mean, we can have our criticisms of the houses, say, in Cabra or whatever, but they're not bad if you're coming from an inner city slum or something, you know? So, I mean, I want to hold that question, right, that for later, right, that how come an impoverished society can house all these people, our wealthy society today can't, right? So you can all hold the question for later. Ellen, was there a kind of I mean, it's funny this when you say, was there an anti-urban bias? Because that seems like a contradiction in terms, because houses are built in cities. But I mean, you were talking there about flats or houses. So was there a kind of an inbuilt prejudice there? Houses good, flats bad, you know?
Yeah, I would say there was. There was after the 1936 census, it was discovered that overcrowding was getting worse and worse, despite this big building campaign in the 30s. So there was a tribunal, and in the tribunal, which was in City Hall, I think, it was discovered that a 3 or 4 roomed flat cost 900 and something pounds. And a 3 or 4 roomed house cost £565. So flats were costing the government more to build. And also flats from the outset, and this is a really interesting point, they were let at lesser rent than the houses. So there was this bias, this was association, psycho-geographical. So they were associated with the poorest of the poor from the outset. And there was growing resentment against them because they were more expensive to build. And then you could suggest strongly that there's a Catholic bias that favours the small holding and the single family. You say goodbye to the world at your footpath and you go into your own domain, which is what happens in a private, in a single family, two-storey house in the suburbs. So it looks like it's happening from an economic perspective. There's also the stigma of the city centre and the tenement slums. And then there seems to be this implicit kind of social and pastoral bias coming from papal encyclicals, which would really have influenced the 1937 redrafted constitution. So it's coming up from all levels, I suppose, I would argue.
So who's the key person here? I mean, is it the ubiquitous John Charles McQuaid?
I think he's blamed for more than he should be, really. It seems to be coming from, it's probably more financial, and it just happens to suit a Catholic social teaching that is gaining traction again through the 1940s. Don't forget, he doesn't come on board until 1940. So it's not like it's happening well before he comes on board.
As I often say, like, you can't blame John Charles for being a Catholic, and you can't blame him either for having a policy. You know, like when other arms of the state had no policy, like in terms of education or whatever. So, like, when we look at these estates now, I mean, they're still there today. They're functioning. Of course, nobody had cars originally, so all the cars are parked outside. But then people don't need garages anymore. What goes around comes around. Can we say that these were a success or a failure, Connor?
A success. I mean, like how much of like Dublin was brought up in like public housing, you know. So I mean, you know, so this idea of other public housing as being slums. Like you really have to look to the 1980s and the change in like policy. Well, really from the 1970s onwards. I mean, banks just weren't interested in like mortgages until 1975. And once kind of banks started, you know, they kind of started moving into selling kind of mortgages. We changed from a mortgage market to, we didn't change from a housing market to a mortgage market. People don't buy houses. Nobody buys a house. People buy a loan, and then they pay back that loan. So what you have here is a mortgage market, and not a housing market, and that's the change in the 1970s. Prior to that, it was building societies, and if you couldn't get a mortgage from a building society, you could apply from the local county council. That's scrapped in like 77 due to pressure from the banks who wanted all that business for themselves. So that shift in the 1970s from a housing market to a mortgage market is quite fundamental.
I just want to come back to that before I do. There's one thing, just a big development in the 60s, which is system-built high-rise, Ballymun in particular. Maybe, Aisling, I just go over to you because, I mean, that was a disaster in the long term. I mean, what's your view on that?
It depends on what we think a disaster actually is. All right, because Ballymun was very self-efficient. It brought neighbours out from the inner city. They created a community. That's where most of our community equity or understanding of helping each other comes from, is those families that created Ballymun and other communities outside. The problem with Ballymun was the same thing that's happening today with Balmain and Clongriffin. The lack of services, the lack of infrastructure, the lack of investment, shops, and services and stuff. So Ballymun wasn't a disaster. It was created to make it look like a disaster. They amplified antisocial, they amplified anything to make social housing look like it's a not good thing. And also you have to remember, when they demolished Ballymun, they brought in the regeneration that was going to be sold as the whole new way of going forward in the private sector. And if you re-look at the regeneration now in Ballymun, that's a disaster.
Okay. Good point. Maybe, Ellen, just over to you in terms of the architecture of this, you know, system building.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with Aisling. Architecturally, those buildings are really, really strong, and they were difficult to pull down, you know, by 2015, the towers. And the houses are still there and loved and lived in to the fullest, and they were really generous by corporation terms as well. But I suppose Ballymun was generally considered, from a design perspective and maybe in planning theories, as a bit of a lab rat. There was a lot of experimentation. But it wasn't the first time we'd system building. There was experimentation in the 40s. There was a really interesting program we don't know about so much around Sean McDermott Street and Gardner Street, where the Georgian houses were reconditioned with these concrete cores. So that was a really interesting experiment through the Second World War, 1943 to 48 or something like that. And then there was another program of building prefabricated, but modern methods of construction, what we're hearing a lot about in the radio and the news at the moment, in Crumlin. So Ballymun was the next step in that, and it came out, I think when we first started talking, we were talking about pre-Free State, and all the housing that happened at that time was a reaction to the Church Street collapse, where 7 people died, Dublin 7. And then there's another collapse 50 years later in 1963, and Ballymun comes out of a reaction to that, a response. So it's a crisis solution, and that's where the modern methods of construction tend to come from. They're given birth out of this crisis. So there's always a bit of hysteria around them, if you like, but they're always, I suppose, prefaced by this kind of, they're supposed to be temporary, they're supposed to go up quicker, they're supposed to be cheaper to put up, and this whole sense of Ballymun being temporary, it wasn't actually, it was actually really, really strong buildings.
Okay, now we've been talking about this kind of as if the public at large are kind of gazing on passively, but of course that wasn't the case. In the 1960s, you had a very serious housing agitation. And I want to go over to you, Aisling, because you're an activist with the Community Action Tenants Union. And I notice on your website, you see this 1960s agitation as your spiritual forebears, if you like. Well, maybe I'll tell you what you do. Could you just explain to us who is CATU, the organisation that you represent, first of all, and maybe go back and talk a bit about the 1960s.
So CATU stands for Community Action Tenants Union. We're an all-Ireland tenants union, the only Irish tenants union actually on the island. Our membership is open to homeowners, tenants in private and social, homeless, asylum seekers in IPAS centres, social housing. The only reason that we felt that the whole idea is that we bring community together because everyone is facing the same issue, no matter if they're homeowners or if they're renting, and communities are being decimated and individualised and kind of pushed away from organising. So CATU is a due-paying organisation, so we don't depend on any state funding, we don't depend on any funding or grants that might hinder our independence. So we are just fully tenant-led.
And can you talk a little bit about the 60s agitation? I mean, I know it's before your time, but...
So I guess what happened was around the 60s and early 70s, communities were being hit by rents, especially around Kilmore Flats. This kind of, we did a project on the rent strikes in Kilmore Flats. We were actually really inspired about how ordinary communities, it was in the public housing sector, so it was just the public housing tenants that got organised. And I guess what we were really inspired was how ordinary people that were affected by the rising of rents, the lack of maintenance, the lack of access to housing, and having to meet all these different eligibilities to be able to access a human right of housing and affordability, that they came together and they were actually able to self-organise within themselves. So local tenants associations started to form over the 60s in different states from across Ireland. You can see some in Dublin, Drogheda, Cork, Mayfield and Cork would have been one, Waterford. So an awful lot of associations started to form. And they were coming from the estates that they were living in, and it was in response to the lack of maintenance and the hike of the rents and stuff. Obviously, work was hard to get, and they wanted to introduce a new type of rents, so they wanted to make sure once a child went to work at 12, because many of them left school at that age, that they were then targeted as paying rent on the income that they were bringing in. And obviously that income that was being brought in by the child that went to work was to actually help give a better life, to provide the food and stuff. So they were seeing it as an unfair rent. So some of the rents were not going to be affordable at all, so it was bringing the rents up. So I guess NATO then formed the National Association of Tenants Organisation, and that was an overbranching organisation that these tenants associations could join up, so that they could actually build a mass organisation and campaign for fairer rents.
Just one thing, I want to go move on to Conor in a second, but one thing that is also part of the story here is staff housing, you know, from semi-state bodies. Like I was brought up in an ESB house, Bordemona had housing, and then companies like Guinness had housing, and usually a pretty high standard. But just like corporation and council housing, it was all sold, you know, it was sold off, you know. Now, you've talked about the agitation 60s. By then, of course, the demographic situation is different. We're now into an expanding population. So our population hits a low in the 1960s, because that's the background noise of this whole discussion, isn't it? I mean, an expanding population and the need to have an expanding stock of houses to house people, putting it simply. So you'd started to move on to this question, Conor, right? But it's the change, like... One thing, for example, is the selling off houses to the occupiers. Now, we now know that effectively means on a mass scale that you privatise what was a state asset, so that the state no longer has control. You know, they've one less club in the bag, to use a golfing analogy. But that's a very hard policy to argue against. In other words, very hard to say to somebody, oh, you shouldn't be buying your house. Right? Do you know what I mean? So can you address that, right? Do you see my point? That it's very difficult, if you have a family living in the house, and they're offered to buy that house on very good, you know, favourable conditions, relatively, it's very difficult to argue against that.
Yeah, I mean, if you want a private housing market, then you've got to have wages that can support a private housing market. Like, I mean, people can have all the aspirations they want. There's a materialist block to a private housing market, and it's wages, and that's it. So in Ireland at the moment, the median full-time wage is around, what, €24,000? So if you want to have a private housing market and have us all as kind of private homeowners, then you've got to have a median wage of around €120,000 a year, and that's for people who work in the Tesco's, who are working in like Aldi and so forth. So, like, people can talk about this, you know, as an individual thing, as if it's about personal choice. There's a structural barrier to any kind of housing market. It's like the myth of Ireland having this kind of the Irish people having a kind of property owning DNA. You can't tell Irish people that home ownership has been dropping since 1991. It dropped during the whole kind of Celtic Tiger of years, because all the narrative was that we're all buying houses and everyone's buying houses and more houses were being bought. But the percentage of home ownership of the national stock has been dropping since 1991. It peaks in that year at around 79%. For the very same reason that it peaks in the former Eastern Bloc countries in the year 2000, because all the public housing stock has been sold off. So that's now kind of washed through the entire kind of system. So in Poland, at one point, it was 97% home ownership, because they sold off their public housing stock and they had more of it, being a former kind of communist kind of country. So that's now gone. So now we're into a situation where people are a bit like those kind of soldiers in the First World War, who are feeling this kind of phantom leg and are thinking back to, we can have this private housing kind of market. You can't on €24,000 a year. So either kind of have wages that can support a private housing market, or build social housing, and that's it. So people, they can have all the aspirations and the talk shows and talk to Joe as much as they want. Makes no difference. There is a material reality that is blocking that whole kind of policy, and that's why we have social fracture at the moment.
Personal add-on, if you like.
I grew up in a house at Cabra, and my mother grew up in a tenement. And the reality of Cabra was the houses were actually very well built. This beautiful joinery in the house of Cabra, they're built on almost an arts and craft kind of style, not quite Amsterdam School, but more arts and crafts. You had a stained glass window in your little, in your front door. You had a little stove over your fire, and that little stove could heat the food. These are the original houses. Now, by the time my mother gets in the house, the guy before has taken out the back boiler, and it doesn't work, right? But it was actually put in that you had a little stove that the fire would heat, so you could actually warm up your food. You could also keep a little kettle going and so on. And there were a lot of details that were actually very lovely in those houses, speaking of somebody who grew up in them. Now, one of the things I would advocate, and I know I'm against this policy that I'm about to advocate on loads of levels, but I'm just going to give you like a personal attack on it. My mother came to Cabra from Mountjoy Street, and they would have lived in, they would have had five rooms in the house. So it's not all tenements, was everyone jammed into one room. So they actually had more space in Mountjoy Street than they had in Cabra. My mother was always buying furniture the wrong size, and all the rest of the house was actually smaller. So these are weird things that are just, not all stories are the same. But I do remember she came on a higher quality of rent, and there was a rent that was called differential. And I can't remember how this works out because I was only a child. She paid a higher standard of rent than other people did, and paid it for a very long time. Now, without sentimentalizing this or bringing it to personal, because this isn't what the debate is about, my eldest brother has cerebral palsy, so she was, you know, and he's fine actually, but it's quite mild. But she would have had children, she would have had three of us, and they were paying this rent endlessly. And I remember the debate in her house, because no one had owned anything in the shape of a house, when those houses came to be sold, that she could buy it for €800 and pass it on to my brother. And I remember us all saying, we just have to do this. There's no debate around this, because we can't leave somebody with an actual disability homeless, do you know what I mean? Because I don't think the houses were automatically given to the children. I don't know that they were. Now, you please contradict me, because these are all childhood memories. But I remember the sense of relief, and she was still paying for that house on a tiny amount of money when she died. They still didn't fully own the house. It wasn't like she had money, but it was suddenly that ability to feel the security and to drop that incredible stress of feeling you were leaving someone vulnerable, even more vulnerable, after you passed away. So the ability to buy the houses on some levels was an extraordinary advantage. I know the implications of that are really difficult.
So I guess this comes back to the rent strikes that happened in the 70s and finished in 73. So the right to buy the properties came from the rent strikes across Ireland that was led by NATO. And obviously it was a great win for people that were thinking like, oh, great, we can own our own home. But like that, they moved into home ownership, and we start to see the decimation of the tenants associations and into resident associations. So although they did get this sense of security, an awful lot of people ended up also in debt now with a bank or with other lending things. But the allocations process is that whoever lives there is on the rent, the council home should be passed down to the family that is still there. So although it was a great idea to start buying your properties, anyone we interviewed, so we did a research project of interviewing people that had lived during the time, had access to the house and then bought, every single one of them have said that was the wrong decision that they made, that they should have never agreed to sell the properties.
Thanks. Oh, you can hear me, Grant. Yeah, I think you were saying it before, but there's like a narrative that, as you said, like it's in the DNA of, it's an Irish thing to want to own your own house, because like, you know, goes back to emigration and the famine and stuff. But yet that wasn't the case in the 30s or 40s. It only really happened like in the 60s, 70s. And I know a lot of people say, oh, this is like a Thatcherite thing, but correct me if I'm wrong, but like how he was actually the kind of the blueprint, and I think it's more goes back to just the actual foundation of the state being kind of like a corporate a test, you know, to like try and get everything to be run like a corporation. So I don't know. I think it's interesting bringing in the talking about it as if it's a psychological thing, and not actually just a straight up policy. But I don't know if you, I suppose the question is, do you think that it's, when did that actually occur that that narrative was made? Because I don't think it was there as much in the 30s, maybe I'm wrong, but that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, it's one of those kind of quirks that we're so kind of filled with this kind of post-colonial self, you know, kind of self-hatred, that we can't even believe that we invented this kind of neoliberal idea. It didn't come from Thatcher. I mean, she has that in like 1980. And this is like 1966. For urban housing, fucking rural housing, it's the 1880s, there onwards. But like even when those houses were kind of sold off, it was less than market rates, and the mortgage was cheaper than your rent anyway. So it was a whole kind of incentive there for that. We now have a market-based private housing and market-based social housing. One of the most bizarre, it's almost Orwellian, is definition of like social and like affordable. That's based on not on income, but based on the market price, and it's then like, you know, it's a percentage that's knocked off market price. My argument is that we can have all the aspirations we want, but unless you raise wages to able to then have a functioning private housing market, which would then kind of increase wages to around, like I was doing just the maths on the way in, to around about 2,000 euros a week would need to be your wage, you know? So if we're not going down that road, then we have to have social housing that's based on like income, or have what we have now, which is a completely dysfunctional social housing kind of system. Like, I mean, home ownership in Ireland is around 60. It's like even during the kind of Tiger years, it was about average in the EU, but every single program told you that we are born with this kind of desire to own our own kind of houses, and it's horseshit. Yeah, people want to live somewhere. Like, I mean, just I'll just mention this, but like, I mean, I grew up in like even more on the north side, and I know you interviewed, you know, can you know, it looks like my neighbours. And I asked them about when they first showed up and did everything about kind of buying their houses, and they went, that's like asking me about, you know, I do want to buy my own aeroplane. It was just something that was just kind of bizarre. But it was so cheap that they kind of fell into it then. But that's a once-off payment. All that capital that was built up over 60, 80 years, that's now all been spent. And we have this policy now that wants a market-based housing market, but doesn't want market-based wages for that market-based housing market. And you can't have both.
No, just going back to this thing of our DNA, you know, proclivities for, you know, owning our houses. There is a legal background to this, though, right? And it's kind of ironic because one of the great struggles in the 19th century was the land struggle, you know, the land acts, right? But it seems to me like if you look across the water, Britain, there's a far bigger culture of because it's a big industrial society, right? So, you know, massive public housing and so on, right? But one of the downsides, I think, of that revolution, it was a revolution in land ownership, is that it enshrined private property and put it on a pedestal. I mean, one of the things that comes up, I mean, going back to housing agitation, is that any time the concept of private property is threatened, like by an occupation or something, they send in the goons, right? And they're backed up to the hilt by the law. And the reaction to the housing agitation in the 70s, right? And I remember as a child, because, you know, it's funny things you remember, the Forcible Entry Act. I mean, people often ask me when I'm, you know, in Berlin and places like this, like, you know, how come you don't have a squatters movement in Ireland? Why? Because you'd be dragged off to jail, right? And you'd be physically assaulted, like, by some guy with a cudgel, right? I mean, Ashley, you want to just talk about that? Because there's been some really, really, I'm not, maybe you're the victim of one of these, but no, but I remember that one in a few years ago where they then smashed up the toilets and it was like, I mean, this was the physical assault, like, right? Just talk to us about that.
So I guess when we're talking about the just two different elements, I suppose. There's the legal evictions that happen, and then there's the illegal evictions that happen, and then there's the occupations and stuff. So I guess, like, with the one with the toilets and stuff that was came in and smashed in, that was an illegal eviction. So that was a notice not served. It was goons just coming in and asserting their rights, as to be like, get out of our property, this is our property, and they went in, smashed up the toilets so they couldn't use the toilets and stuff like that. And then the legal avenue that they have to take is to go through the RTB, and that can take up to 6 weeks, and you're already out of your home. And then if the adjudication points not in your favour and stuff like that, you don't really have much recourse because you don't have access to a solicitor yourself. We don't have a legal right legal aid for housing issues. So you're really left on your own when you're in these situations. And for the occupations and stuff like that, when we have been involved, say, in Apollo House, Take Back the City, and previous occupations, like that, once again, it was you go through the courts and it's back to how the judge reads the legislation, and we don't have a right to a home in the constitution, so therefore that was kind of like where we lose when we go through the courts. Same with the squatters' rights, it's the exact same system. So realistically, a right to a home is a big, massive legal issue that's missing for us in housing, so we don't have a right to a home.
Now, Linda's discussion, the implication here is that this is a class issue. Now, it is a class issue, right? But it's a cross-class issue, right? Because the point now is nobody can afford a home. I mean, can I just take a quick straw poll there? I mean, how many people here are still living with their parents, right? Yeah. Yeah, well, I don't know when my lot are going to leave, but... And there's no prospect of them leaving either, you know? And, yeah, when I moved out, when I was 21, you know. Yeah, you know, I wanted to get out, have my own place, right? And there were these kippy kind of flats in Dublin you could still get, you know. God, there were some horrible looking places, but at least they were your own, you know. Like, that was the thing, you know. So Conor, how, you know, address that. Like, so that this is a societal problem right across the board, right? It's not just people at the bottom.
No, it's not. No. I mean, it's a structural kind of issue, because there's been a huge kind of structural change in terms of housing. You know, I mean, like even in terms of the policy, I can see there was a not so much a kind of game changer, but things did change after the banks blew up in like 2008. Because what you get then is that it's like vampires. They can only enter your house if you invite them in. And they say to you, am I allowed in? And then they come in, and they were invited in like 2011 and like 2012 as kind of housing policy. Going back to another myth, and that's the myth of the bank crash in 2008, that was caused by commercial property. Commercial property blew up. So what happened is that the state spends up to 40 billion, that's a net loss of kind of 40 billion, it's a guarantee of kind of 400 billion, to kind of protect a commercial kind of developers. So when the housing market kind of blew up, they needed another solution. And the solution was that kind of majority bring in the vultures.
Just going back to the bank bailout, right? I thought this was a capitalist society, right? That if you took a risk, you took the consequences, but apparently not if you're a bank.
No.
If you're a bank, you're protected. Like, what was it described as? Socialism for the rich and, you know, capitalism for the poor, right? Okay, now, this raises the question, right? Is this deliberate policy? Okay.
100%. It's been, that's the thing about... But 2008, we can chart this in real time, which is very rare. It just happened. But from 2011 onwards, you can see them saying that we need REITs first, and then it's ICAVs, and we need all these kind of different kind of corporate structures to like solve housing. And what we're seeing here is a pure extractive model that is being kind of played out, and it is completely in line with that kind of thinking.
So, just explain what you mean by extractive model.
Well, Well, I mean, like, if you look at, like, housing up to 2008, even though housing was, like, falling and like, house purchases are no longer less than kind of market kind of value, that was being kind of papered over by extremely cheap credit. So you're getting, like, loans at, like, 2%, 1%. It was linked to the, you know, if it's a contracted mortgage, it's at less, it's like 0.1% there always. That all goes. So now we have this kind of private housing model that is just like, that's the way forward. But we don't have wages then for that, nor access to credit to kind of pay for that kind of gap forever. So then the big thing is that social housing or kind of, you know, rents is the way kind of forward. But now we have this issue that, like, what is being brought in are kind of transnational capital whose sole objective is to hit that 3.5% guaranteed return for their investors, whatever way they can, by any means necessary. And they're being given the entire kind of keys into the whole system, even down to chain. Like, one of the, they had an entire shopping list that they said, we want these changes to the law before we move in, including, you know, kind of making it easier for evictions. And that was, and the government at the time bent over backwards and changed that law then for them. So this is completely in line with them. And even though in the kind of bald figures, these kind of private kind of companies don't seem to be a huge kind of part of the overall kind of market, they are setting policy. So national policy is being geared towards their interests and not the societal ones.
Okay, I want to just throw in another issue that comes up, and all you would-be artists, just pay attention to this. And this is this thing of, you know, the myth of artist-led gentrification, Connor. Should all these people here be feeling guilty here, right, when they move into their little houses? Don't worry about her.
Sorry, am I hogging this? Is this okay? No, it's okay. Okay, no.
No, I don't have this expertise. Okay.
Well, I mean, like artist-led gentrification, it is the ultimate kind of gaslighting. I mean, like, it's just gaslighting, because what usually happens is that private capital moves into an area, buys up kind of vacant properties, sits on it for 10, 15 years. During that period, while it's being emptied, they then kind of, you know, kind of let it out to artists because they know that they can get rid of them easily. And then what happens? They get rid of the artists from these kind of cheap kind of studios, build kind of stuff then in it, and the narrative is, oh, the artist made it trendy. Oh, people fall for the biggest kind of I mean, God bless you. You know what I mean? Like, you know, that's not what's going on here. They have plans for 10, 15, 20 years. If you look at plans for, like, Smithfield, those plans were drawn up in the early 90s. And you had this idea that, oh, it was artist-led. And isn't there all? So what I'm saying here is that when you trace the flows of capital through a city, that's when you start to see these kind of correlations at a policy level. Because there is no market. We know this, that this cannot be kind of market-led, because if it's being kind of market-led, then it must in some way be income-led. This is obviously not income-led. If housing in Ireland was income-led, we would not have housing at €400,000, €500,000. It's obviously not income-led. It is investment-led, and that's a different thing.
Ashley, do you want to come back on the gentrification issue?
Yeah, I guess
it does happen. Just artists and everything.
Yeah, no, I think artists are exploited, and it's completely used to up the kind of level. Yeah, because obviously we've got an awful lot of artists in the union, and obviously they come to us and they talk to us about kind of how they're being exploited between the rents and sharing houses and studios is a massive one, and even trying to access studio spaces is a massive problem, like, for an awful lot of our members, and they're all part of the artist union or something. But like that, we don't feel that would be the artist's fault. They're being exploited to give this extra lift of income, like, to make it look like it's more attractive to come to, because the street art is gorgeous. The stuff that we see happening around our communities is massive. So they're using it as a way to say, like, oh yeah, it's this great part, trendy part of town, when they're exploiting the people that are living there and what skills they actually have. Gentrification, that we can go down to the IFSC, that's where the real gentrification is happening. Do you know what I mean? So when you go down to the IFSC, you see right beside you, you've got Sheriff Street, and then you've got right beside you the financial area. And realistically, what they have done is that you can see the poor, not the poor, but the working class and the rich divide. They have massive apartments that nobody can afford that's from the inner city. They can't afford to live there. And then you've got them not investing in the communities beside it. Do you know what I mean? So they're allowing those communities to come down. So for the gentrification, it is a model that they want to bring in investors, bring in people that can afford to live in the nice, shiny apartments, while they're pushing all the working class right outside of that.
I think in Dublin 8 and in Dublin 7, we hear quite a bit about it in the Liberties, but you might speak about it being here, but also in Dublin 7, where the Greek Street flats are, and behind the fruit markets, there's been this incredible stagnation of the locals, and then these big student housing blocks and Hamptons by Hilton. And it's shocking to see the scale of a 1930s flat blocks where you have hundreds of families living and they're completely overshadowed by these big student housing blocks and hotel. We're not talking about Dublin 7 at all because you've got the legal bastions. We are talking about the Liberties more and more, and I'd be interested in hearing about them.
Yeah, well, you just have to walk down the bottom of Mead Street and have a look at all the social or the student housing. That's unaffordable for most students, I presume, here. And then we've got our social housing stock that's actually been really left to rot. And you can see that this is a really valuable patch of land and capital in the city, and you can just see what's actually going on with the lack of funding for community centres are left to rot. There's no football pitches for young kids to play, and we're, you know, these children are set up to fail, and we kind of guess what that might be all about. If what you say, that Connor says, is like follow the capital, you can see what's really happening in the city.
Okay, we always have to give people hope, right? So I want to move on. What are we going to do about this? I mean, what are the solutions? Ellen, might I just go to you first? I mean, does architecture or technology have any role in solving this problem?
I think it's kind of mythical. It's a little bit like what happened with Ballymun and other experiments with system built. It often has this association with lesser quality, which isn't true. So it carries often stigma with it. And it's back to what Aisling's saying is about bringing the services along, or bringing the services first and then bringing the housing following that. So within architecture, I mean, I would think that generally speaking, the architects have been pushed out to the periphery of this problem and keep trying to elbow their way back into the centre and keep getting pushed out again. So I don't know where architecture sits with all of this. We're trying to train the next generation of architects, but we're probably thinking more about the climate crisis and look, that's kind of where we're at the moment, more than anything else.
This goes back to the point Aisling made. You're suggesting that the dysfunction of Ballymun was deliberately encouraged. Am I right? Did I get you right on that?
Yeah.
So in other words, given system building a bad name, right? So no more of that, right? Yeah.
History, your neighbour, NCAD's neighbour, which you can literally see over the wall, I think is exactly kind of territorial stigmatisation going on there. I think it's exactly the same as Ballymun. It's been set up to fail.
So we met with Dublin City Council last week and we had a conversation about all the blocks that were kind of built, 1930, Kilmore, Pier Street, Ballymun, and we were discussing kind of like what is the plans for them, because they're not putting maintenance into the individual flats themselves. They might maintain outside to make it look okay going past. But the issues that are happening within the flats themselves are a massive issue. Some plumbing, heating, leaks, the whole lot. Like, so realistically, what we feel, and from the conversations with Dublin City Council, is that they're going to inspect them, they're going to like get rid of them, and they're going to be knocked out and saying they're not a good thing. But when those do get knocked down, what's going to be the replacement? It's not going to be council properties. It's going to be outsourced to the private sector. It's going to be regenerated to the private market. So that's what the issue is going to be. So the responsibilities of the councils for their tenants and making sure that they live in safe, provided homes is now going to be outsourced. And people have been used to living in council kind of rules and stuff like that for so many years. Then all of a sudden they have to transfer. Majority of people that wait for the regeneration, move out of the community, and they never come back, because by the time the regeneration programme happens, so we're talking about gentrification, we're actually talking about that kind of happening as well when we start replacing the blocks of flats. Back to the architecture answer, we did work with architects in UCD at one stage, and community consultation is a massive thing that's not happening with the policies. So when you have architectures kind of come in, nice buildings or might be nice ideas, the community is not involved in that kind of development of kind of what type of homes, how the community might look, what is needed. So that is some aspect that I would love to see the schools carry on, to start like really pushing community consultation.
Connor, I want to wrap up soon, right? Just in terms of, you know, possible solutions, like what needs to be done?
Well, I mean, but it is consortium. You know, no, it's fine. Well, Wilcato have a wonderful kind of report that they worked on last week that does kind of deal with this. But like, it's a very, very simple one. It has to be income led, and that's like, and that's kind of family income led. So, like, we have an investment extractive-led housing policy at the moment. How can we get a guaranteed 3.5% kind of return for these kind of vulture funds? And national policy is set up to try and kind of feed into that. But what we need is a housing policy. Like, housing and jobs go kind of hand in hand. It seems, based on kind of international kind of figures, historically, 40 breakdown seems to work in terms of private versus public housing, and that's public, not rental housing. It has to be public rental housing, not private kind of rental housing, because then that is still kind of market led. There has to be an acknowledgement, at least, that you cannot have a market led housing system, because we don't have the wages or the income then for that. And that's why states have always kind of come in to try and kind of bridge that gap. If you do have a market-led housing policy, you will have slums. You will have slums. So, I mean, that's the trade-off.
Now, I mean, are there any of our political parties in the Dáil addressing this question at all, Conor, in your opinion?
I don't think they are, because they've all seemed to most of them seem to have bought in to the government's kind of definition of what is kind of social housing and like social rents, which is a market-based kind of kind of model. Which is, it's so bizarre, it's so crazy how we have a social and affordable model that's based on protecting the profit of the private companies and not based on what people can afford. The average rent in Ireland, kind of nationally, based on national income, should be around €400 a month, and that's for your own housing unit, not a room in a shared house. So that shows how far we have decoupled housing from income, because they even ask for €400 amount a month for your own place. Seems like fantasy kind of these days, even though that was the norm even kind of 10 years ago. So that's what I mean by you need to get back to this. And the biggest block is the state, and that includes kind of local councils. But local councils have two things which they leverage. They have property and they have time. And they leverage both to service capital. They will sit you out. They know that they can just like run things down for like 20 years if like need be. So it's completely kind of policy led. And it was led by policy, it can be changed by policy.
Does anybody have any insight on approved housing bodies? Because from an architectural perspective, the most interesting housing that's been done has been done by those bodies. And in terms of maintenance, they are maintaining their properties and more than local authority from a Dublin perspective.
Okay, so approved housing bodies is taking a gulp of the housing investment money that should be going into Dublin City Council because they have a different funding mechanism to get it. But realistically, they are a private entity and they're regulated under the Private Residential Tenancy Act. Although they are under that, that means that they have obligations of maintenance and can take legal procedures through the RTB to hold them accountable. But what we're seeing is that the rise in the amount of investment in approved housing bodies and provide not only now social housing but also affordable homes, that they can't, they're not going to be able to keep up. Do you know what I mean? So the staff is now becoming landlords who were originally social care workers and they're now moving into landlordism. Do you know what I mean? So realistically, when there's issues, which we have found and seen, where children that have autism or ADHD and complaints have gone in about those children for antisocial. So realistically, there's a massive problem that's going to evolve in approved housing bodies. The money should be reinvested and re-put back into Dublin City Council, and Dublin City Council need to strengthen their estate management. That's where the money should be going. Approved housing bodies, same as Scotland, we've seen the decline in the maintenance in Scotland. They have a massive issue when they sold off all their council properties to the approved housing bodies. I don't find them as a solution. I think they're part maybe of the solution, but not the overall solution. Too much money's been put into them.
Now, I'm going to have to wrap things up here. We may not have solved this problem, but I think the first step in the solution to any problem is to analyse it. And I think there's been some excellent analysis here people can take on board. I just want to pass the mic over to Nina, who put this whole operation together, just for a few words.
Thank you all so much for coming. I hope it was interesting for everyone here from a variety of perspectives. I put this talk together as many of the speakers were influential in my research process, and the theme of this installation is around being suspended in your childhood worlds and from that point trying to develop imaginaries. And I think art is a very powerful tool for creating imaginaries. So this is kind of just a way to contextualise the situation that so many people of my peer group have found themselves in. And I hope you all found it really informative and maybe gave you some potential to imagine things. Thank you.
Thank you, Nina. It just remains for me to thank our panel here, Ellen Rowley, Conor McCabe and Aisling Haderman. Big thank you to Alex on sound. Now, our next History Ireland Head School will mark the 250th anniversary of the death of Daniel O'Connell, the Liberator Reassessed, and that will take place in Glasnevin Cemetery Visitor Centre at 4 p.m. on Wednesday the 30th of July. So I hope it might see some of you there. So thank you all very much for coming along, especially those people who contributed from the audience. Thank you.